excited, of course, to have our first in-person colloquium for a while. And the speaker is our very own Kendrick Smith. So brief introduction to Kendrick. He is originally from Fairbanks, which is a town the north of Alaska, whose other main resident is Santa Claus. He did his first PhD at the University of Michigan on algebraic ecology. And then his second PhD, he switched to experimental cosmology, where he worked at the University of Chicago, where he worked with the DAPMAP experiment. He is famous for inventing and implementing fast algorithms to carry out difficult statistical analyses on cosmological data sets. There are some good examples of this. So there was one was he got the first action of gravitational lensing in the CMB. And then there was another kind of interesting thing, which may not be remembered now, but there was about 10 years ago, people began getting interested in looking for non-Gaussianity in the CMB, and there were several groups that claimed to have detected it. There was a lot of excitement about that. And Kendrick evaluated the optimal estimator for FNL and showed that wasn't true. There actually is no evidence, and so he was absorbed into the WMAP and Planck collaborations to help with their subsequent analyses. And then most recently, he has struck again with the Chang telescope and the FRBs that he'll tell us about. So are you ready, Kendrick? Please take it away.
Thanks. This is the first time I've stood in front of a room full of physicists to talk about physics in about 2 years, and I'm really excited about it. Really excited to be giving a talk in person and having cookies in person afterwards and chatting with people. So novel. By background, I'm mainly a statistical cosmologist, but for the last few years, I've been spending part of my time pretending to be a radio astronomer because I'm really excited about this project and future projects. I'm going to concentrate on the science results related to fast radio bursts, since that's the part that I've mainly worked on. Let me say that CHIME is a collaboration of maybe 150 or so people, with large teams at the institutions shown in the top and smaller teams at the institutions in the bottom, including Perimeter. Here are some high-level bullet points summarizing CHIME. CHIME is a radio telescope. It's a compact interferometer with no moving parts, except for one universal moving part, and that is the Earth's rotation. So as the Earth rotates every day, the beams from CHIME sweep out the whole sky, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. It has a, by the way, I'm told there's nothing we can do about this box in the corner, so I'll just try to pay attention and read out the things that are obscure. The size of the collecting area is around 80 meters on a side. You can't really see it in the picture, but each of these four cylinders is instrumented with 256 antennas or feeds. So there are a total of 1,024 feeds in the system. CHIME observes in software-defined frequency channels between 400 and 800 megahertz. That radio frequency range was originally selected for cosmology using the 21 centimeter line in neutral hydrogen. And the redshift range, which is called the so-called redshift desert, but that happens to be a very interesting frequency range for other things, including the FRBs that I'll talk about today. And CHIME has many science goals, but in this talk, I'm gonna focus on FRB science. So I wanna just start by helping you get as excited as I am about this telescope. So I want to start by just talking about the instrument a little bit, and I want to contrast the CHIME design to a traditional radio telescope shown here, which is one feed stuck in front of a single dish. The single feed radio telescope focuses by physical delays. The optics of the telescope are arranged so that a bundle of rays coming in from infinity at focus will have the property that all of the path lengths to the feed are the same. A bundle of rays coming in from a different out of focus direction would not interfere constructively. Now I want you to imagine getting rid of the dish and simulating it in software. And what I mean by that is I'll replace the dish by a series of antennas shown as red X's, one antenna per square wavelength approximately. And imagine digitizing the electric field at each of those locations and then summing the electric fields in software with a pattern of delays which can be arranged to mimic the focusing of a dish pointed in an arbitrary direction. Now you might wonder, so you could repoint the telescope by changing the delays. Now you might wonder what you gain by doing this, and in fact you do gain something very interesting, and that is that because digital time streams may be copied freely, you can repeat this computation to focus on different parts of the sky in parallel and gain the sensitivity of n telescopes pointed in different directions, where n is the number of beams that you can afford to compute. Chime represents an extreme case of this concept, where we have 1,024 feeds and enough computational power to form and process all 1,024 beams in real time. So it may seem too good to be true, and I'll tell you what the challenge is in a few slides. But Chime has, for most purposes, Chime has the statistical power of 1,000 different telescopes, all pointed in slightly different directions. I want to show a few slides just to show how Chime observes as at cartoon level. These slides will be sort of important throughout the talk. So any individual antenna in the system sees the so-called primary beam shown in the left panel. That primary beam is a long strip because Chime is focused in one direction and along the short axis of the cylinder and unfocused along the long axis. The Chime design is sort of a compromise between optical and software focusing. Then by taking all the antennas in the system, which all see the same primary beam, and doing software beamforming as previously described, we can form a pattern of 1,024 so-called formed beams, which have much higher angular resolution. And then this whole pattern of primary and formed beams is fixed in the coordinate system of the telescope. But as the Earth rotates, it sweeps over the northern hemisphere. And so every 24 hours, we get to image the sky with an angular resolution of around 1/3 of a degree. That's the angular resolution of the formed beams in radio frequency range 400 to 800 megahertz. Now here's a fun table, which is just quantifying the things that I talked about in the last few slides. So for most purposes, you might surmise, and this is roughly correct, that the statistical power of a radio telescope is proportional to its mapping speed, which I'll define crudely as the collecting area multiplied, which is setting the sensitivity per beam, multiplied by the number of beams that you can process, multiplied by some order one factors like bandwidth, system temperatures, and so on, which I've ignored in this crude back of the envelope comparison. So with that simple definition and in some weird units, which no one actually uses, Chime has comparable or better mapping speed to these other famous radio telescopes in the table. Here's what a ridiculous statement that is compared to, say, FAST. Here, FAST and Chime compared to scale. FAST is one of the most ambitious and expensive projects in radio astronomy. It's a 500-meter telescope in China. And Chime is this little grassroots by comparison effort with like 1% of the budget. So a few years ago, when I was thinking about this, I was wondering, this seemed too simple to be too good to be true, but then this calculation seemed too simple to be wrong. So I was trying to figure out what was going on. And here's the challenge. That the product of A and N, the mapping speed, you should think of as in principle sensitivity under the assumption of infinite computing power. But the computational, and if you want to maximize that product, it's much cheaper to increase N than it is to increase A. But the computational cost is proportional to the number of beams, since that is just setting the total data rate. Or maybe worse, it could be like the square of the data volume, depending on what you're doing. So the Chime design is not just a way of getting something for nothing. It's a sort of a strategy of moving difficulty from hardware to software. We were proposing that we would build this relatively small radio telescope and confront hard challenges and hard problems in software later. Just to get a little bit of a sense of Chime's computing, I won't talk about these slides much in an overview talk, but each one of these boxes represents like a large supercomputing cluster, which would occupy like a whole shipping container. And I've indicated the different data products that are formed and sent out over these networking links. Just to roughly quantify the level of computational challenges, I've shown some data rates here. And I like to convert this to astronomers' units and express them as multiples of the LSST telescope. LSST at 15 terabytes per day is often considered to be an example of big data in astronomy. But Chime's data rates are hundreds or thousands of times larger. Here at Perimeter, we worked on the sort of central low-level software that searches for fast radio bursts. And I'm going to say what fast radio bursts are in a few slides. And this software was written over a period of a couple of years, and it's orders of magnitude faster than existing software, also more statistically optimal. It's a better matched filter. And it has some crucial properties for Chime. We have, in Chime, we're really flooded by a lot of human-made radio transmissions, or RFI, and we need to flag those in real time to make sure we don't confuse them for astrophysical events. That is, I would say, the largest technical challenge. Our search also needs to be like a real-time, low-latency search, since there's far too much data to ever save it to disk and, like, you know, process it afterwards. We just have a short in-memory ring buffer, and if the search does not complete while the data is still in that buffer, then it's as if we never picked the data. Just for fun, I've shown a few, I've included a couple of slides that show the level of code optimization that we ended up with to do this on reasonable resources. So here's some ordinary C++ code to take the transpose of an n by n matrix. You might think that there's not much that you could ever do to optimize this besides testing which ordering of the loops is fastest, which I already did. Here's some code that is 4 times faster. This is some assembly language code, or it's C++ statements that map to individual assembly language instructions, which is doing like an 8x8 subtranspose in these special SIMD registers on x86 CPUs via a sequence of assembly language instructions, which is apparently very hard for the compiler to find. But a human who is determined to beat the compiler can, once you get a little experience. I just like to include these slides for shock value. I would say they're not actually so representative of most of what we were doing, which was more like algorithms math. But they're fun to show. Okay, so for the rest of the talk, I'm gonna talk about FRB science from Chime. So far, I have not said what an FRB or a fast radio burst is. So I wanna give a few slides of like an FRB mini introduction. An FRB is a radio pulse, which is dispersed. So I've shown in the lower right here. Dispersed means that the arrival time of the pulse depends on the frequency channel where the pulse is observed. The delay is proportional to frequency to the -2. And that is the dispersion relation expected for propagation through a plasma of ionized electrons, which is not too dense. Prefactor is in the dispersion relation is the dispersion measure. And that's just the radio astronomy term for column density, or the integral of the 3D number electron number density along the line of sight. And I'm going to quote this quantity of the DM in radio astronomers' units of parsecs per cubic centimeter. Those are the natural units if you think of the dx as being in parsecs and the ne as being in centimeters to the -3. And just to sort of normalize that, a typical FRB has a DM of around 500. FRBs were first discovered in 2007, but they were controversial for something like 8 years. Many astronomers thought they were instrumental effects and not astrophysical, or maybe atmospheric effects. 2015 is roughly when it was widely accepted that FRBs were real and cosmological outside the galaxy. I forgot to say, it's at the top of the slide, that the defining property of an FRB is that its total dispersion measure, or the number of electrons along the line of sight, is larger than the number that would be expected if you integrate all the way to the edge of the, integrate the Milky Way's electron density all the way to the edge of the Milky Way, suggesting an extragalactic origin. So when Chime started operating, about 30 had been discovered. They would say the subject was still in its infancy. And we've now found 500, and the rest of the world has found about 70. When an FRB is observed, there are no spectral lines, as far as we know, but you do measure the dispersion measure pretty well. Now, a few FRBs, so you don't know where they are. The dispersion measure doesn't tell you whether the electrons are in the host galaxy or accumulated from integrating along the long line of sight. A few FRBs, like 10, and I should say that this plot is slightly out of date, there's a few more that I need to add to the plot, have been associated with a galaxy in an indirect way. If you observe the FRB at very high angular resolution, which a few telescopes can do, then the angular resolution is good enough to associate the FRB with a unique galaxy. And if that association is unambiguous, then you can observe the galaxy outside the radio in optical or infrared and get a redshift that way. So with 10 points here in the redshift DM plane, it does look like FRBs are usually cosmological, and we've associated them with host galaxies at cosmological distances, and that the DM is like a noisy distance indicator. And as another way of helping you sort of calibrate these DM units, a FRB at redshift Z, if you integrate the expected electron density of the universe, mean electron density out to that redshift, you'll get a number that's around 900 Z. Now, the cosmological distances are what make FRBs so interesting. The implication of those huge distances is that to explain their observed brightness, they must be ultra energetic, like many orders of magnitude larger than radio pulses that the brightest radio pulses that were ever seen from well understood sources in our galaxy, suggesting a new emission mechanism. And explaining the origin of these ultra bright pulses has become, in the last few years, I would say, a central unsolved problem in astrophysics. Next, I'll tell you about repeaters. So prior to CHIM, one FRB had been observed to repeat. This FRB, which is now called either the original repeater or R1, since CHIM and other experiments have found more, now called R2, R3, and so on, was a goldmine of information, since finding FRBs in a blind search is expensive. But if you have a repeater, then you know where to look. You can just point a telescope there. And this FRB was super well characterized. In particular, it was the first FRB observed with high enough angular resolution to get a host galaxy. I'll show the details later, but I'll just say now that in the first year of operation, CHIM found 18 new repeating FRBs, establishing that repeaters are, you know, not an isolated phenomenon. It's an open question in the field. Yes?
So the
repetition timescales, there is a wide range of repetition timescales. Some FRBs, some repeating FRBs repeat fairly regularly, and others repeat rarely. Most of the FRBs that we found with CHIM, we've only seen repeat once. In other words, the distribution is dominated by the rare repeaters. So it's an open question in the field whether all FRBs repeat at some level, or whether repeating and non-repeating FRBs are different types of objects. Like, you might imagine that there's just more than one reason that you could get a bright radio pulse. There's perhaps a historical lesson here from gamma ray bursts, which were an unsolved problem in like the 80s, where it was eventually found that what was thought to be one type of event was really two different types of objects. And the assumption that there was only one reason why you'd receive bursts of gamma rays was kind of an obstacle to figuring out the correct theory of those objects. So I think with FRBs, people want to be open-minded. You might imagine, for example, that a repeating FRB could be a neutron star, and a non-repeating FRB could be some sort of cataclysmic event like a merger. For what it's worth, at a recent online conference, a poll was taken, and the audience was nearly 50-50 split. Here's my theory slide, which is really lame. In this talk, I can't do justice to the huge variety of models that have been proposed, except to say that people have started writing papers that catalog all of the different models. I think I found it hard to keep up with all the different models that have been proposed. I used to have the excuse that there was just such a huge variety that it was hard to see which ones I should be paying attention to. Now, as I'll show in a few slides, the results from CHIM suggest that FRBs come from magnetars. And even before CHIM, I think there was a lot of speculation that magnetars could be the engines that power FRBs, like the energetics and total number are about right. But even within the magnetar models, there's a lot of like internal variety. Like, there are models where a magnetar is surrounded by a supernova remnant, and the magnetar emits some ejecta, and when the ejecta crash into the supernova remnant and shock, that's where the FRB is produced. Or there are models where the FRB pulse is generated in the magnetosphere. And you know, even within those broad categories, there's a further like subcategories of models. So I decided at this point, there are about 20 or so interesting FRB science papers from CHIM. I decided, rather than trying to talk about all of them, just to highlight a few of them to talk about in a little bit more detail. So first I want to talk about what happened when we first turned Chime on. We spent a couple of years writing this code, and then it was ready. And then we expected to need a few months to take like engineering data and tune things. But what actually happened is that almost right away, like when we were still building the system and like building new computers and plugging them in and so on, we started finding FRBs. We found in our first month of engineering data, we found 13 new FRBs, including the discovery of the second repeater. So almost right away, we were the best FRB telescope in the world in terms of event rate. We were on the cover of Nature, which is prestigious and sometimes correlated with being a good paper. I should say that one big risk when we started Chime is that Chime observes at lower frequencies than almost all of the FRB's detections that had existed to date. And searches at frequencies a little lower than Chime had all been unsuccessful, which suggested it was a common speculation at the time that there was some sort of spectral cutoff, which would have meant that Chime would not have, you know, we would have had a little bit of sensitivity at the upper edge of our frequency band, but overall we would not be that powerful as a FRB detection experiment. So we were really worried about that, but we didn't have that problem. We don't even see a preference for having more FRBs at the upper end of the band than at the lower end of the band, like we see them everywhere. And since Chime experiments, it has happened that experiments at even lower frequencies than Chime have been successful at finding FRBs. So I think the hints of the spectral cutoff were just a statistical fluke when there wasn't much data. I should say it's probably obvious, but I want to say it for completeness, that in this slide and in subsequent slides, I've shown FRBs in the frequency time plane after correcting for the dispersion delay, the frequency dependent dispersion delay. So these are images of what the FRBs would look like if they hadn't been dispersed by the electrons between us and the FRB. As I mentioned previously, we found lots of repeating FRBs. Here's from our first year of data, we found 18 repeating FRBs. Now I think is a good time to mention that when we detect an FRB, it's sometimes a bit of a judgment call to decide whether to classify it as an extragalactic FRB or a pulse from within our galaxy, from like an interbit pulsar or something like that. We classify it as an FRB by comparing the observed dispersion measure to the maximum dispersion measure that we expect by integrating a model of the electron density to the edge of the galaxy. And the models are kind of noisy. Like, for example, if you look at the first object on this list, R3, the observed DM was 350 parsecs per cubic centimeter. And the predicted galactic maximum is either 200 or 325, depending on which of two popular models you choose. So given that level of disagreement, it's a little close for comfort. When we wrote these papers, I personally thought that R3 and R4 were about 95% likely to be extragalactic, and the others were pretty unambiguous. For many of these, like at high galactic latitudes, the expected galactic DM might be like 30 or 40, and we'll see a DM that's like a few hundred or 1,000 or something like that. So it's usually unambiguous, but sometimes it's a judgment call. Now we now know that R3 actually is extragalactic. We know a lot more about that FRB, and I'll explain shortly why it's a particularly interesting one. Another thing that we saw right away, especially in the repeaters, is that there's this downward marching pulse structure, where if you look closely, the pulse is not really one pulse. It's like a sequence of subpulses separated in time, whose central frequency is getting smaller from one pulse to the next. And the different models will try to explain this using different plasma physics explanations. Like in a shock model, maybe what you think is one shock is really like a sequence of shocks. And the electrons that are shocking, are their Lorentz factor is decreasing from shock to shock, which does lower the central frequency. I want to talk for a few slides about R3, the third repeater ever discovered and the second repeater discovered in Chime, since this turned out to be a super interesting object. As mentioned previously, its extragalactic DM is small, suggesting that it's at low redshift if we didn't screw up the classification. Now, the Chime's angular resolution was not quite good enough in this case to uniquely identify a host galaxy, even if you restrict the search to galaxies at low enough redshift to be consistent with the DM. We sort of outsource our VLBI follow-up observations. So VLBI stands for Very Long Baseline Interferometry. There are these instruments like the EVN, which are a bunch of telescopes scattered all over Europe. The long baselines give fantastic angular resolution. The angular resolution of a radio telescope is roughly its observing wavelength divided by the characteristic baseline of the instrument. So the angular resolution of the EVN is fantastic. It's like a few milliarcseconds, and allows you not only to figure out which galaxy the FRB is in, but even narrow it down, tells you where in the galaxy it went off. You can narrow it down to this little star-forming region on the outskirts of the galaxy. So this galaxy is a spiral galaxy, which is very similar in like mass and properties to the Milky Way. And it's at redshift 0.03 at the time the closest FRB found. Now we eventually notice something totally unexpected in this FRB, or to give credit where credit is due, a graduate student, Dongzhu Li, and former PSI student at PI, noticed that the activity of this FRB is periodic. I want to distinguish between periodic activity and periodic pulses. Periodic pulses would mean, like for a pulsar, that there's some like underlying very strict periodicity, like the ticking of a clock, where there are only very special periodic sequence of times when you can ever see pulses. What periodic activity means is that there's a 4-day window every 16 days, and we only observe pulses within that window. But within the window, the timing of the pulses appears to be random as far as we can tell, and there's no periodicity within the window. So just to explain the observations and the analysis, the red triangles are the days when we observe pulses. Do you recall that Chime sees every point on the sky once per day? Numbered each pulse with the number of pulses that we observe on each day, although we don't actually use that information in our analysis. And then the gray bands are not observed. We just noticed, or Dongzhu noticed, that if you draw a series of bands with 16.35 day spacing and 4 days in width, then you only see red triangles inside the gray bands. The first question you might ask is, What's the statistical significance or probability that that would happen by chance as a statistical fluke? And that analysis is simple enough that I put it in one line. For each red triangle, the probability that you would fall into one of the gray bands is 4/16.35. That's the width of the band over the spacing between the bands. And then there are 11 triangles, so I've raised it to the 11th power. I should also include a trial factor here to account for the fact that I laid down the gray bands in a way which was tuned to the data. If you count the number of possible ways that you might have chosen the gray bands, then omitting the details of that counting, you get a trial factor of something like 270. And that gives a statistical significance of around 5 × 10⁻⁵, or around 4 sigma. And I should say that this was published at the end of 2019, and the periodicity has held up in Chime and other experiments. Had a lot of influence on the models. Different models try to explain this somehow as arising either from like the orbital period of a binary. Like if you imagine that the FRB is in a binary system, then maybe part of the orbit is like covered up by some stuff, like a cloud of electrons, absorbs the FRBs via free absorption. Or in other ways, like there was a nice paper by Huan Yang here at PI proposing that it's related to the aberrational period of a precessing neutron star in a binary, like the same way the Earth's orbital axis precesses every 26,000 years. And a neutron star at that time can be much shorter. Next, I'll talk about the observation that I think has had the greatest impact on the field. And it's really simple to explain. We saw what we think is the first FRB in the Milky Way. And we identified which object it came from, a known magnetar, SGR 1935. The reason that FRBs are a puzzle in the first place is that they're many orders of magnitude brighter than the brightest pulses ever observed from neutron stars in the Milky Way. But in April 2020, we observed two supergiant pulses from a known magnetar with an energy that was orders of magnitude larger than anything that had ever been seen in our galaxy. As a detail, CHIME saw two pulsars, the ARO telescope in Ontario saw the first pulse, and the STARE 2 telescope in Caltech also saw the second pulse. Here's a plot from the STARE 2 paper showing that this closed most of the energy gap between galactic pulses and FRBs. The FRBs are the blue cloud of points here, and the orange cloud of points is known sources in our galaxy. Now, I should say that there was a little bit of debate as to whether or not this event should be classified as an FRB. One argument that has been, I think that it should, but for completeness, one argument that has been raised against it is that its energy is lower by a factor of 10 or so than the faintest FRBs that had been ever been discovered at the time. With the discovery of more FRBs since then, especially another FRB in CHIME that's in the nearby galaxy M81 that I chose not to highlight, that's no longer the case. And the distribution of FRB brightnesses does include this event. Another thing that is a little weird is that, previously I showed a downward marching pattern of subpulses. And this event shows an upward marching pattern, which would be rare for an FRB. But my feeling is that, in the CHIME catalog, about 1% of our events, or a few percent, do show this upward marching structure. So given that there's a few different ways that an event could look a little fishy for an FRB, one source of fishiness with the statistical significance of a few percent is not surprising. To me, this event does not particularly look like an outlier within the CHIME FRB population. One aspect, so this is huge because it tells you for at least one FRB what type of object it came from. Now, one aspect of these observations that I want to talk about a little bit, since I don't think it got much attention, is that the timing of the radio pulses with X-ray pulses, which were observed by several X-ray telescopes that were active when this event went off. That in itself is a huge milestone. It's the first time an FRB has been associated with emission outside the radio. Now, to compare the timing of those pulses, I want to define the arrival time lag, which I've defined so that the sign is positive if the radio pulses arrive after the X-ray pulses. And I should say that prior to this observation, all of the magnetar models, as far as I know, predicted either positive lag, the radio arrives later, or zero lag, that they arrive at the same time. So it was very puzzling when the first X-ray experiment to report, Integral, found that the X-ray pulses were arriving a little bit after the radio. That is, that the lag is negative. Now the plot thickened when a couple more instruments reported. So after Integral, there was I'm building up the observations here in a plot where the blue colors are the radio timings and the red colors are the X-ray timings. STARE 2's reported timings for the second pulse agree well with CHIME, and the statistical errors are tiny compared to the radio, the X-ray statistical errors. So the next experiment to report, InSight HXMT, reported X-ray arrival times, which were also after the radio arrival times, and consistent at about 10% with the integral arrival times. and increase the overall statistical significance of the negative lag, just 8.5 sigma. However, the plot thickened when a third experiment, CONUS Wind, reported arrival times that were in very close agreement to the radio arrival times, but they did not report any error bars. So you might interpret the situation as a bit ambiguous, and you might choose to interpret it, I think, in two different ways. One way would be to just throw out the CONUS Wind points since they didn't report error bars. According to my reading of their paper, they were just were thinking more about other things, like the energy spectrum of the events, and were just not so concerned with a detailed analysis of the time. But for whatever reason, they didn't report them. So you know, if those points didn't exist, then it would look pretty solid that the lag is negative. That I think would be extremely constraining. Like, as far as I know, it actually rules out all the models that have been proposed so far, and it must be some sort of very strong thing. The other way you might interpret this is to say, well, these instruments probably all have similar time resolution. The large scatter compared to the error bars just suggests some sort of undiagnosed systematic. All we can really say is that the X-ray and radio events have arrived at roughly the same time. I would say, due to a theory prior, that is the way that these observations have been almost universally interpreted. It's a puzzle. I think what will really settle it is like one more observation. If we see another event like this with radio and X-ray, then I think it'll be clear.
Ken?
Yes?
Is the X-ray like duration similar to the radio duration of these bursts, or is it like much longer?
I believe it is on the order of milliseconds. But maybe see in this plot.
Which is probably X-ray. So the emission is much more, much longer, it looks like.
There are these narrow peaks that are on the order of milliseconds. I'm sort of riding on top of this broad peak.
So there is some X-ray photons coming before the radio bursts are seen.
Oh, well, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Next up is the CHIME FRB catalog, which is just a wonderful source of population statistics. So we recently published a catalog of 500 FRBs, around 18 of which are repeating FRBs. That's actually just our first year of data. That's data ending in July 2019. So this is a modest fraction of the total number of FRBs that we have seen but have yet to publish. The reason that it took us a long time to publish and this analysis is hard is that having this number of FRBs is a wonderful opportunity to do statistics, but it also means that you need to understand the instrument really well. Like, for example, to interpret something that you think would be straightforward to interpret is like a histogram of DMs. But to properly interpret that, you need to know the selection function or the probability that if an FRB had gone off with a given DM, that we would have detected it and it would be in our catalog. So correcting for and dividing by the selection function of our instrument is what makes this hard. Our approach is, I changed the slide right before the talk, so the old one's still in there. So the challenge is modeling the selection function of the instrument. We built a Monte Carlo pipeline, which simulates pulses in software, injects them in real time into the search, search software, and then just sees whether they come out at the other end. That just runs commensally with the real search. So the search is doing two things. It's finding real FRBs, and it's also finding the simulated FRBs to model the selection function. This is sort of technical, but it'll come up in a few of the slides. I want to say that the way that we model the pulse is as a convolution of a Gaussian and an exponential. Width of the Gaussian is supposed to be the intrinsic pulse that you would see if there were no propagation effects. So its width, W, is independent of frequency. The decay exponential is the what's called scattering in radio astronomy, or the effect of multipath propagation along the line of sight. If the electrons between us and the source have small scale inhomogeneity, That scattering broadens very rapidly with decreasing frequency. So the time scale of that exponential is proportional to frequency to the minus 4. So the intrinsic width can be distinguished from the scattering time in the parameter fitting in two ways, either because the time dependence is Gaussian versus exponential, or because the frequency dependence is different.
So is this scattering happening mostly near the FR source itself, or is it happening like anywhere in the line of sight?
I don't think that the data tells you that directly. The IGM, the intergalactic medium, is not expected to be turbulent enough to generate the level of scattering that we see in CHIME. We also don't see much of a correlation between scattering and the FRB's location in our galaxy. So we think that most of the scattering must be produced close to the FRB. We do have a paper which shows that compares the level of scattering that we see to the level that would be expected in the host galaxies, and finds that we do see more scattering than would be expected. So we think that some of it is probably coming from very close to the FRB. But I think that there's a lot of modeling assumptions and uncertainty in what these host galaxies are like. You'd probably say that with more confidence later.
But is there any correlation seen, between this amount of scattering and the DM in, for each verse?
That is a good question that I don't know off the top of my head. The scatter plotting, scattering versus DM. Offhand, I don't know. That's something I could easily check, but I don't know the answer offhand. So we have grade constraints on the FRB population. For example, the FRB luminosity function, or the number of FRBs above some threshold brightness or fluence, is a power law with exponent minus 3/2. That's the so-called Euclidean power law, minus 3/2, or it's consistent with that within statistical errors. Deviations from minus 3/2 are expected either because the universe is expanding or because there are subtle selection effects in CHIME that could change it. But we haven't seen it yet. There were some earlier hints of an FRB luminosity function that was very different from Euclidean, with much larger. But in CHIME, we don't see evidence for that, and our error bars are very small. We can also do things like constrain just the overall rate of FRBs. We quote that rate in kind of a funny way, where we quote it as the number of FRBs after cutting out some regions of parameter space, like FRBs with DM below 100, where the sensitivity of CHIME is kind of bad, so the rate is not very well constrained. We have histograms of interesting population parameters. One interesting case where the selection function analysis does change the conclusions qualitatively is the scattering timescale. In the lower left, you'll see the distribution of scattering times that we see in our raw data. But it looks like it's decaying pretty quickly above some value, like say 100 milliseconds. But it turns out that what's actually decaying is our selection function, or our sensitivity. And when that is corrected, the distribution looks pretty flat. Maybe there's a hint of a decrease that's shown in the lower right. And so what's probably happening is that the distribution of FRB scattering times just continues well out below the point where it's difficult for time to observe them. One interesting thing you can do with the CHIME catalog is compare population statistics for repeating FRBs and non-repeating FRBs. And we find that they're the same. With only 18 non-repeaters, the statistics are not great, but within statistical errors, we find that they're the same for most parameters, but do differ for two parameters, the width shown in the lower left. Repeaters are wider statistically than non-repeaters. And also the bandwidth, or just the fraction of the frequency range from 400 to 800 megahertz, where we see FRB flux. Repeaters tend to be narrower. a lot of people seem to interpret this as evidence that repeaters and non-repeaters are different types of objects. You know, since there's some hints of, well, bimodal would be too strong of a word, but different distributions for the two types. I don't think, you know, you can say for sure from looking at plots like this, but it's fun to speculate. And my speculation when I look at this tends to be the other way, that this suggests to me that repeaters and non-repeaters are the same type of object. It's sort of unsurprising that something would be a little different. Like if, say for example, that FRBs are magnetars and young magnetars repeat a lot and older magnetars are rarely observed to repeat, then it would be unsurprising if there was also some reason why young magnetars emitted narrower bandwidth pulses. But it's quite striking, it would be quite a surprise if they were really unrelated types of objects, that all these other things would be so similar, like the DM distribution, the scattering distribution, and so on. Especially when you note that things like DM and scattering, you know, they have more to do with where the FRBs are located than with the intrinsic properties of the FRBs themselves. It would just seem to be too much of a coincidence that those distributions are the same if they're really just unrelated. But I think we don't really know yet. That's just my, I'm just sharing my speculation. Oh man, almost out of time and only 10 minutes left. Or I still have three things to talk about. Well, I'll try to just highlight the highlights. We've statistically found spatial correlations between FRBs and galaxies. This analysis was led by my PhD student, Masood Rafieh Ravandi. As previously mentioned, CHIME does not have angular resolution to associate FRBs with galaxies on a per object basis, but you can still try to associate them statistically by looking for spatial correlations. That is, in a part of the sky with a lot of galaxies, you might find an excess probability for finding FRBs. Or if you're familiar with the cosmology notation for describing this sort of thing, you compute the angular power spectrum CLFG as a function of angular wave number L. And we tried spatially correlating the CHIME FRB sample with a bunch of different galaxy catalogs and found correlations with three different catalogs, all at redshift of around 0.4. Now, one aspect of these correlations that is puzzling is the DM dependence, or the strength of the cross-correlation when the FRBs are divided up into DM bins. So in this plot, I've taken a slice of galaxies at a redshift of around 0.4 and correlated with the CHIME FRBs. And you see this huge spike at a DM of around 800, a huge correlation. That's surprising, since you would at redshift 0.4, the cosmic DM is only around 400. So if there's really a population of FRBs there with DM 800, then the host DM would need to be around 400. And that has not been seen yet in any of the direct host associations. So in our paper, we argue that such a population could have been missed so far due to the small number statistics of those host associations. So I think it would be unsurprising if that population of FRBs at redshift around 0.4 with DM around 800, if that emerged soon. We look at a lot of alternate hypotheses and I think exclude all but one, which is strong lensing. So to make a long story short, I think there's still a chance that these are strongly lensed FRBs at higher redshift that are spatially correlating with that are observed in gravitational lenses that are spatially correlated with low redshift galaxies. I had to go through that kind of fast, so I'm happy to chat about it in more detail afterwards. I don't want to miss talking about a very recent paper, which I think is super interesting. So a few FRBs show this pulse train microstructure. So in this example, there's a period of emission lasting a few seconds, where if you look closely, it's made up of a bunch of subpulses. And each of those subpulses can be modeled pretty well by our scattering model as a decaying exponential with a frequency-dependent width. And so then that model is a good fit. So this would appear to be a very highly scattered train of pulses. We notice that the arrival times are nearly periodic. If you look at the arrival times in the lower right here, then there are a few gaps, but if you fill in those gaps, then the spacing between the pulses would be about the same. And that turns out to be a very high statistical significance statement. In the upper right, I've plotted the arrival times on the y-axis. And on the x-axis, I've just chosen some integers with a few gaps to make the points fall on a straight line. And the periodicity is just showing up in the excellent fit of these points to a straight line. Now, the formal significance of this turns out to be something like 6.5 sigma. It's like the scatter off the straight line is so small that this is incredibly unlikely to occur by statistical chance. So we've observed a different periodic phenomenon from the one that I talked about previously. This is like not periodic activity in a repeater, but strict periodicity in a sequence of subpulses within some broader pulse. One thing that I think is super interesting about this is that this FRB, as far as we can tell in Chime, is not a repeating FRB. But a 217 millisecond period is extremely suggestive of a neutron star origin. 217 milliseconds is a very plausible rotational period for a neutron star, and all sorts of neutron star observables have that periodicity imprinted on them. So this would be evidence that we've already seen evidence that repeating FRBs are associated with neutron stars generally or magnetars specifically. This to me suggests that the same is true for a non-repeating FRB, and suggests that non-repeating FRBs are unlikely to be an unrelated phenomenon. Okay. Finally, I'll talk a little bit about what we're doing next. So if you think of the statistical power of an FRB telescope as being determined by two numbers, an event rate and an angular resolution, then in Chime, we're just crushing it on event rate. But our angular resolution, as mentioned a few times, is sort of a limiting factor. So pretty soon, we'll also have the best angular resolution. And the way that we're doing that is we're building these Outrigger telescopes. They're like little miniature copies of Chime. Thousands of kilometers away. When those are running, the angular resolution of Chime, the wavelength divided by the separation between the outriggers in meters, will be something on the order of 50 milliarcseconds. And so for most FRBs, we'll have VLBI angular resolution, and we'll be able to get a host galaxy and even tell where the FRB went off in the galaxy, which will just be an insane amount of data at Chime's event rate. And so these are expected sometime in 2022. We're also building CORD, the successor experiment to Chime, where through a variety of technical improvements, we hope to get a mapping speed around 8 times higher than Chime. The CORD Pathfinder, a 1/8 scale version of CORD, should be ready in mid-2023. With the full instrument in like late 2024 or early 2025. Perimeter is an institutional collaborator in CORD. Right now, just a few of us are helping to build CORD, where by build, I mean writing software. But I want to say that if anyone listening is interested, either if you like to build software or you're just interested in chatting about new ideas to do with this new instrument during the building phase, then please come and talk to us. So it's pretty amazing that for around $20 million, which is small for a new telescope nowadays, you can build the world's most powerful radio telescope. But you'll have to deal with this huge data rate, and you'll find that this is a machine for transforming astrophysics problems into computer science problems. But we hope that we are solving these problems and that they will only need to be solved once, and we'll release our software. And this will be like the beginning of an era of large N and clever algorithms. Chime and CORD are really ambitious steps in this direction, but there's some challenges, things I didn't talk about, like pulsar search algorithms, where we'd like to do a lot better. On the hardware side, there's like a clear path to scaling up by like a factor of 1,000 or so in the near future, in the next 15 or so years. I think it's super interesting, and it rarely happens that subfield of astronomy, suddenly this path appears to scale up by orders of magnitude on not too long of a time scale. I'm really excited about expanding into this new discovery space. This slide is largely a bullet point list of things that I didn't have time to talk about that we're also thinking about doing with Chime. For fast radio bursts, aside from the just immediate task of exploring the phenomenon and figuring out what they are, I think the cosmological applications will be are underexplored and interesting to think about. Things like using dispersion measures to map out the electrons in the universe, or using fast radio bursts with their very narrow time structure as probes of strong gravitational lensing, for example. There's a whole program in Chime and Chord to do cosmology with a 21 centimeter line in neutral hydrogen by mapping out the 3D distribution of neutral hydrogen throughout the universe. And finally, I think we can really clean up on pulsars. We can find a lot of new pulsars and time existing ones better to do things like new tests of GR in its weak field regime, but very precise tests, and maybe give a new window on gravity waves. So that's it. I ended at 3 o'clock exactly to the second. Thanks very much.
All right, well, thank you for the great talk. Can I ever ask if there's any questions from students either in the room or on Zoom? Yeah.
I have a question that might be very simple, but how do you identify that once you receive a signal that it's a repeater from some signal that you have observed before, or if it's a new one?
We just compare the location on the sky. And then the DM, which is sort of like a radial coordinate, and see if they agree.
You do have to worry about
the chance occurrence probability that would happen by chance. And that is currently starting to become an issue. So it used to be the case when we didn't have very many objects that whenever we saw two pulses from like the same sky location and DM within statistical errors, we were pretty sure it was a repeater. But now our catalog has gotten large enough that in some cases we need three.
Okay, but the signal doesn't have the exact features or look exactly the same to be a repeater. It's just...
No. And in fact, it's often observed in repeaters that the things like the frequency spectrum of the FRB will change from pulse to pulse.
Any other student questions?
Yes, yeah, so I want to share with the modeling of the transition. So, do you take into account the fluctuations in the electrons? Like, there can be narrow regions where there's a lot of fluctuations in the electrons.
Oh, yes.
So, how do you model that for the transition?
Oh yeah, so that would be like part of the noise. Let me go back. Let me go all the way back to. So if I've understood your question correctly, then in this plot, if you were looking through like a homogeneous universe with no galaxies, then the FRBs would lie exactly on this line. And then the scatter around the line arises because there are fluctuations in the electron density like along the line of sight. Including like the large galaxy, which is the host galaxy of the FRB, which is itself a large fluctuation in the electron density. And I think you're maybe asking what this distribution looks like. And it is the case that, it's a very non-Gaussian distribution with a long tail. If you go through a void, then the electron density is zero. But if your line of sight happens to like go right through the center of like a dense halo, and at the center of the halo, the density could be like 1,000 times larger than the mean density of the universe. So there is there is expected to be like a very asymmetric distribution with, apparently you can't see it in the spot with only 10 points, but I think with more data, you would undoubtedly see that this is that the scatter here is very symmetric and that there would be some points up here, but not down here. I think that's what you're asking. If not,
you still see that after including the fluctuations, it still allows you to tell if they're cosmological, not hexagonal.
There's still a strong correlation here.
Okay, can I ask a question? I mean, somehow the central question for me is so you
the fact that you see the FRB in our galaxy, which is a magnetar, sounds like it's rather strongly suggestive evidence that FRBs are magnetars. I mean, I kind of want to jump to that conclusion. Is everything else consistent with that conclusion, or is there any particular evidence that seems to not suggest it's a magnetar, or any sense of how is that? Should the betting person be betting that they're basically all magnetars at the moment, even if it's not?
Oh yeah, I'm not aware of any really similarly strong piece of evidence that would favor any of the non-magnetar models. In my mind, at least, there's the question of whether maybe some of the non-repeaters are some unrelated phenomenon. But in my mind, at least, it's pretty safe to assume that at least some FRBs are magnetars. But there's a big variety in the different, surprising for me as someone that doesn't do much compact object astrophysics, a huge amount of variety in the different models that have been proposed for the emission mechanism.
I guess maybe one thing I was wondering about is, so I was under the impression that in terms of this millisecond substructure that I think I was under the impression that pulsars that are rotating and with millisecond time scales tend to be kind of old, low magnetic fields, whereas magnetars I thought were supposed to be earlier, sort of younger, slower rotating ones. Is there any tension between the speed of the subpulse period?
Oh yeah, 200 milliseconds would be, it's maybe lower than average, but it's within the range of sort of ordinary periods for a young pulse.
Okay. Any questions online? So if there are no further questions, let's thank Kendrick again for a great job.